Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. I recently had a conversation with Rowan Braybrook. She's on the staff of the Northwest Natural Resources Group, a nonprofit that's based up in Seattle, Washington, and they're deeply into helping landowners, municipalities, other organizations who are interested in maintaining or creating healthier forests. And so let's listen in and see what Rowan's got to say about what she does. We're really pleased to have Rowan Braybrook with us today. She's with the Northwest Natural Resources Group. And Rowan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's just start off quickly. If you give me maybe the 30,000-foot overview of what the Northwest Natural Resources Group is, and just for our convenience, we'll just refer to it as the NNRG from here on.
It's definitely a bit less of a mouthful that way, yeah. NNRG is a nonprofit that's based in Seattle, Washington, and we work in both Western Washington and Western Oregon on forest stewardship. So we work with a number of different partners from local municipalities, individual family forest owners, and different tribal groups to steward their forests in a way that is ecologically sound.
Okay, and then just to underscore what you said there, so national forests, federally owned forests are not part of your area of interest.
Right, they have their own foresters, so don't need quite as much help from us as maybe some of the family foresters could use.
Okay, and just a bit about you. I note on your bio that I picked up off your website that you're from the San Juan Islands, and so that means you're maybe it goes under the heading of local girl makes good here. So you are from the San Juans?
Yeah, I grew up on both San Juan and Lopez Island, a little bit further north from, I'm guessing, from most of your listeners. But I live in Bremerton now, so I'm slowly working my way down the Sound.
Yeah, well, we think South Sound life is pretty cool. Bremerton's not far away. And personally, I've spent many happy hours boating in the San Juans. Sometimes it's been on my way up to British Columbia, but gorgeous country up there. And I always like to underscore how blessed we are to have such a beautiful natural environment here in the Northwest and how important it is to me and I think to most people to preserve that for our kids. So just a little bit more about you then. How did you, a bit about your background and how you came to be at NNRG.
Sure. Well, my previous hat was actually in international conservation. For a number of years, I was working based out of Washington, D.C., you know, the other Washington, as I say to my friends who insist on calling their city Washington. But I was working in D.C. for a number of years on international conservation, mostly with a focus on the U.N. with climate change, biodiversity, and sustainable development, and then also with a number of countries individually working on national level implementation of their different sustainability and climate goals. But, you know, the Northwest called me back, definitely wanted to make it back here at some point, and wanted to stay in the conservation and environment realm, so was very happy to shift into another much more local nonprofit with NNRG. So I'm still making good on my namesake. I'm sure you know Rowan is a type of tree, so I'm continuing to work with trees, and it's almost like my mother named me with that with that in mind.
Yeah, it does seem sometimes like our names do call us to particular things. Mm-hmm. I've got a grandson whose middle name is Wilder, so I'm interested in seeing how that one's going to work out. So how long have you been back in Washington State then?
I've been back for about 2 years. So I moved back in 2019.
Well, welcome back for sure. And with your experience in forests in other countries, that must really give you a somewhat of a unique perspective on looking at our forests when you've seen how things are done and what forests are like in other countries?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, of course, things are a little bit different everywhere with the ecology. You have to keep the local ecology in mind, because even going a few dozen miles, the local ecology can change in geographically diverse areas, much less going halfway around the world and looking at tropical forests. But, you know, wherever you are around the world, forest ecosystems are, you know, on the climate front, providing that carbon sink and providing that stability, local climate stability for the communities around them. So happy to be back in the evergreen state, looking at a different kind of evergreen and looking at those local forests now as well.
For sure. So noticed in your bio on the website, I believe this phrase was a little bit tongue in cheek. It says that you gain considerable expertise in UN acronyms in the process.
Yes.
So you did work with or for or in conjunction with the UN for a while. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I was working in several different UN fora. So that's where the letter soup comes in. I was working with the UNFCCC, which is, of course, related to climate change, the CBD, number of different other alphabet soup organizations in the environmental and sustainable development world.
So we're going to focus on Washington State for obvious reasons here today, but I can't help asking you, with your association with UN, what's your 30-second assessment of how nations are doing in terms of the Paris Climate Accords?
My 5-second assessment is that good, but could always be better, or even okay, but could be good. For those who might not be as familiar with how the Paris Agreement is set up, essentially every country is invited to submit a nationally determined contribution, and that is essentially each country's promise to lower their emissions however they want to do it and however it makes sense for their local economies. So some countries, it might be mostly reducing transportation emissions. Other countries might be looking at their agricultural emissions. The only really binding things happening with the Paris Climate Agreement is that countries have to report on the emissions over time. And then once they achieve a certain reduction in emissions, they can't go back up. So each country is submitting its own essentially promise to reduce emissions. Some are more ambitious than others. Right now, the trajectory that countries are on, certainly it's not where we need to be in order to keep below 2 degrees of warming globally, but it is better than it would be if we didn't have these policies in place.
Okay, well, I'd say that's an interesting perspective, and not one I hadn't really thought about that before. So one of the things we could compare is Paris Accord as it might be and how things might be without it. So I'll keep that in mind as I work on my optimism about the future. So enough about all of that. So let's talk about Washington State or the Pacific Northwest, Oregon too. We don't need to be exclusionary. Looking at the at some of the goals that are expressed on the NNRG website, it appears to me that NNRG is really focused on adaptation. Would you say, is that a fair assessment on my part?
I think that's one of our major areas of focus. And I think the reason for our focus on adaptation versus mitigation is that there are more actions that an individual landowner can take with adaptation as opposed to mitigation. You know, with mitigation, it's keeping trees in the ground, keeping soils healthy. With adaptation, there is a lot more action that individual landowners can take in order to keep their forests healthy, regardless of size of forest. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to make clear, of course, this is a climate talk program, but when we're talking about mitigation and adaptation, of course, we're talking about that in relationship to climate change. So is climate change one of the key considerations that or areas that NNRG is focused on?
Yes, it definitely is, because we see it having such a long-term and pervasive impact in all of the lands in the Northwest. It's always hard to see exactly what the world is going to look like in the future. None of us, unless you're a very good tarot card reader, I suppose, none of us really know the future with that degree of accuracy. And even the best and most accurate projections can only give you a rough idea of what we're looking at in 20, 40, 60 years. But it's really necessary to look at some of those projections, because the forests that we're planting nowadays, they aren't forests for tomorrow. They're forests for 30, 50, 100 years from now. So with forests, we really don't have the luxury of changing from one day to the other and then hoping all of a sudden that those actions will have massive impacts in the resilience of forests in the Northwest. We're really looking for the long term, because that's, forests are, of course, a very long-lived ecosystem, and, we'd like to keep them as long-lived as possible. So we're really looking at the longer time horizons.
Yeah, so clearly you need to use some models. I guess I would think that you would need to use some models in doing projections. So how do you manage that? How do you figure out or come up with estimates of what the future is going to look like as you make your recommendations?
Well, there's a lot of science out there and a lot of really reliable science looking at different projections. The world in 20, 40, 60 years might look a little bit different depending on our actions in the next few decades. But we are going to see across the board kind of the same types of phenomena, the same types of impacts, regardless of what that temperature increase looks like. Maybe it will be more severe, maybe it will be less severe, but the good news, given that trees need a number of decades to grow and the forests need a long lead time to adapt, is that we're not trying to thread a needle with a particular scenario. Most of the recommended actions we have are going to be useless. Most of the recommended actions we have will be useful regardless of whether we have 2 or 4 or 6 degrees of warming. One of the things that we're really looking at is the sourcing of seedlings. So that might be kind of one more specific exception to the rule that I kind of just mentioned, which is if you're looking at seedling sourcing, you might be looking at a different zone for a native seedling versus picking a seedling that was grown just down the street. So with that, then you're looking a little bit more carefully at, okay, are we going to be an optimist or a pessimist here with some of those projections that we have? Are we going to assume, 4 degrees Fahrenheit as opposed to Celsius of warming, or maybe 8 degrees Fahrenheit? And if so, how does that impact where we're sourcing those seedlings from?
Yeah, that approach seems to make sense to me. In fact, I apply something very much like that, I think, in my personal life, because as you say, none of us really knows with assurance what the future is going to hold. So when I plan for the future, I try to make sure that I'm going to do something that's going to work in a number of different scenarios. And it sounds like that's the approach you're taking.
Yeah, exactly. And the good news is also that a number of the actions that you can take create healthier forests regardless of climate change. So, regardless of climate change, some of the actions that you take to address the potential droughts for climate change also impact the health of the trees and the forest ecosystem more generally.
So we did speak briefly about mitigations, and so it does seem that healthy forests are a mitigating force in themselves, aren't they?
Absolutely. And the healthier the forest, the more mitigation potential, with, a footnote there with there are a lot of details in terms of the species and a lot of the local details that are happening in a particular forest. But forests are champion carbon sinks. We know that, I think. Elon Musk a few days ago came out with a $100 million proposal saying, okay, who can give me the best carbon sink, carbon sequestration technology? I'll give you $100 million. Like, pick us. Yes, we already know. We're even happy to split it with the soil folks for healthy and sequestering soils. So, it's a technology that we know, and it's a technology with a lot of positive co-benefits across the board for biodiversity, for water quality, for air quality. With most of the actions that we take to keep forests healthy on the adaptation side also have positive benefits for mitigation. If you're addressing the effects in this case, you're also addressing some of the causes and addressing some of the push of temperature increase in the first place.
Yeah, I read a book. It's a fiction book. You may be familiar with it, called Overstory, a few months ago.
Oh, yes.
And one of the thoughts that I came out of that book that I hadn't really occurred to me before, I hadn't thought about it that much, is that trees are basically made up of carbon they've pulled out of the air, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the carbon dioxide. You know, if you think back to high school chemistry, carbon dioxide, you have one carbon molecule and two oxygen molecules. And, you know, we know that trees like to breathe in carbon dioxide. So they breathe in that carbon dioxide, they yank off that carbon molecule, put it into their own growth. So they're increasing their size. And then they allow the oxygen molecules to float back into the air for us to breathe. So it's a great, efficient technology.
Yeah, it's kind of like magic. I mean, if we didn't have trees, somebody'd have to invent them.
Yeah, so. It sounds like Elon Musk might be trying to.
Yeah, well, good luck in your conversation with Elon. I'm on your side for sure. Once again, kind of browsing through your website, came across this item. It says, "We advance the state of knowledge about ecological forestry, spread the word about its benefits and feasibility, and help landowners to put it into practice in their own forests." So the question that pops up for me there is, what is the motivation for landowners to follow your guidance? And I guess before you start, there's a little insinuation in there, and that is that typically, at least in our culture, landowners want to maximize financial value from their land. So that must be in the mix there somewhere.
Well, it really depends on the type of landowner. You might be thinking more of the industrial landowners, which are certainly have more of a profit motive and more of an economic motive when they're doing their long-term forest planning. But we're mostly working with family landowners, municipalities, and tribes. So, you know, taking family landowners as an example, a lot of family landowners feel a responsibility of stewardship, and they don't just have an economic motive. Certainly economics are important. You know, in our society, we all need a little bit of income in order to feed ourselves, in order to take care of our families. But a lot of those landowners feel a larger responsibility of stewardship because of what they've inherited or what they want to leave as a legacy. And there are other landowners, the municipalities, for example, that have a responsibility to citizens of our region to continue on in appropriate stewardship. So they're responding to the will of the taxpayers and the voters in order to have healthy standing forests that are protecting watersheds and protecting air quality in the Northwest. You know, certainly if you're talking clear cutting, of course, that's the most visible example of some of the types of land management that we see in the Pacific Northwest. And that is a way to, you know, get rich quick. It's a type of approach where you want to maximize that economic income for the work that you're doing. Ecological forestry, which is the type of approach that we take, is more of a get-rich-slow strategy. You're not going to make as much money up front, but if you're looking to have a legacy for your kids or a legacy for the children of taxpayers or even just yourself in 30 years, it can maximize the yield over time because as you raise trees to have the older ages, then you're able to both have that as part of a environmental stewardship as part of your land and also as kind of an investment where maybe instead of tapping into the investment itself, you're just tapping into the interest that the forest may be able to provide you to keep it providing for itself and paying for itself over the long term.
Okay, understood. So seems like your organization has carved out a specialized niche. And I'm thinking, well, maybe when we look at the big picture of our forests or even our former forests, we got a ways to go. And it does seem like, you mentioned this term stewardship, it does seem like politically as a social construct that we want to be looking towards fostering that idea of stewardship throughout the forest environment, as well as just folks who by nature are interested in going that way, or small political units who are motivated to preserve the environment. Does that sound a rational thought to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Providing that culture and hopefully also providing incentives for larger scale landowners to really look at the big picture and look at the longer term. We talk about sustainable development and sustainability. And of course, for those who are familiar with sustainable development theory, you have three things as part of sustainable development. It's environment, social, and economic. And in order to have true sustainability, you do need to have that overlap of all three, if you're picturing the Venn diagram of those three approaches. So right now, with a lot of larger industry, it is mostly the economic incentives that they're looking for. But in smaller types of forestry, and hopefully in a wiser future that we have for our forests, we can really look more closely at that overlap and find approaches that are, you know, good for society and the environment as well as economics, and, you know, still have that forestry as part of our culture in the Northwest while thinking of ways to have it be more sustainable and have it be more sustainable for a larger sector of the population as well. And of course, larger sector of the population, also thinking about the wildlife in there.
Yeah. So, and I do see some causes for optimism that what you're describing there may happen in other areas. Major investment firms are starting to take a look at the social responsibility of the companies they're dealing with. And General Motors just announced that as of 2035, they're not going to be making any internal combustion engine cars anymore, which is mm-hmm. pretty amazing. And nobody made them do it. So I think that there is some evidence that as a culture that we are starting to take a more of a stewardship approach towards this beautiful world that we were given. And I guess I would say, and I hope so.
Yes.
just a quick aside here. You know, I grew up in Southern Oregon. I grew up in forests. In fact, I lived in a home for a number of years that had big pines all around it. It was up at a little higher elevation in the pine country. And so I know what forests, are. I'm talking mm-hmm. about primal forests. And I just wanted to ask you, we drive along, we see signs up and say, okay, this is a tree farm planted 1970 or whatever. In your view, are tree farms forests?
It depends how they're managed. I know depends is not always the favorite answer, but it really depends on the type of stewardship that individual tree farm is approaching. And it also, on a more academic level, it also depends a bit on what you mean by a forest, just by, you know, what do you mean by a neighborhood? I think in general, if you're managing something like a tree farm, you can do it with more or less attention to more holistic forestry and a more ecological approach. A lot of tree farms, if they're going the plantation route, it is taking a more agricultural rather than ecological route. So you're really planting for that monoculture of a certain tree species. And without that diversity of age class, diversity of species, I wouldn't really consider that a forest if it's not biodiverse enough and if it doesn't have that essential long-term intentionality of being a forest. That's more my personal opinion. But I think that if there are some tree farms that do manage in a more holistic and ecologically friendly way. So it depends.
Yeah, you made a good case for your, well, it depends for sure. And I can see how that is true. And as a layperson, I'm sometimes guilty of just lumping stuff together. So it's nice to have a little bit more clarity on that. And I particularly appreciate your distinction between, okay, are you doing agriculture here or are we doing ecology here? And I think one of the implications in a lot of the things you're saying is that we can have ecologically healthy forests and other places too, of course, and we can also be successful in providing for ourselves and our families and so on while we do that. So, mm-hmm. oh yeah, one other kind of little technical question I came up with. I saw this note in the website referring to cable-based logging. It's something I'm not familiar with. What is cable-based logging?
It's an approach to logging that's usually used on very steep slopes. It's a lot safer than having people going down with chainsaws or going down with machinery that can't handle those slopes. So I can't consider myself an expert in that particularly, but it's mostly a function of slope rather than any particular ecosystem or any particular type of tree.
So if it were spread to more wider use, it seems to me like part of what goes on in the forests is that, especially with this kind of clear cutting approach, is just like massive destruction through there with maybe pulling the logs out, that would be a way of harvesting the trees that were ready to be harvested. It could even be a part of managing the forest and then maybe not leave such an ugly footprint on what's left behind.
Yeah, it really allows for more selective harvest. And that is a lot of what we champion as part of the work that we do, is taking that selective approach. A lot of the forests in the Northwest that we're dealing with, a history of recent mismanagement, where maybe loggers came in 30 years ago and clear cut everything and planted everything in a single species. That's great on the industrial side if you're kind of creating that plantation approach and growing the same trees over and over. And if you want to be very dictionary definition about it, that is technically sustainable. You can continue doing that for quite a long time, just planting the same monoculture and then taking it up every 30, 40, 50 years. But looking at where we want to be in the long term and looking at addressing some of that mismanagement, not all forests are created equal. Just because there are a lot of trees in a location doesn't necessarily mean that it's a healthy forest. So I think probably a lot of people have had the experience of going into maybe a national park or a really well-managed older forest, and they see sunlight coming through the trees. They see snags where there might be some osprey or a woodpecker pummeling away at lunch. They might see all of the vegetation in the understory, small bushes and berries and things like that, that are there part of the ecological diversity and also as part of the broader biodiversity, because they are also there to help feed some of the wildlife that are there as well. But there are other forests as part of that mismanagement I was mentioning. You go in and it's dark and it's dense and there's nothing but fir needles and pine needles on the forest floor, and you have all these very skinny, packed together trees trying to outcompete each other for a little bit of sunlight. And when we see forests like that, it's kind of like when you're gardening at home and you see a bunch of carrots in a row trying to struggle for room in a garden bed. You want to pull up some of them so that the rest can grow and not be as susceptible to drought or disease. That might be pushing the metaphor a little bit, but yeah. So what we'll do in some of that correcting the past mismanagement is go in, look for some of the less healthy or less desirable trees, take those out, hopefully having a income for the landowner in the process, or at least having the action pay for itself. And then over time, those trees that we leave have more space to grow. There's more sunlight coming down through the canopy to that forest floor, and it allows for a greater diversity of species to continue growing there.
So are we seeing signs now that climate change is affecting forests?
Definitely. It's always hard to tell on a year-to-year basis, but if we look at the data going back over a number of years, we can absolutely see the impacts of climate change over time. We're used to, or at least I am very familiar with this idea of threat multiplier. Climate change isn't necessarily the only boogeyman in a situation, but it's that threat multiplier that takes something that would have been perhaps a minor nuisance or one-year issue, and it turns it into a much larger issue. So we've seen that summer droughts are starting to get longer and drier. More precipitation is arriving in, those atmospheric river events that don't really recharge soil moisture in the same way that our traditional drippy moisture in the Northwest does much better. We don't see as much snowpack in the higher elevations, which then also means that the lower elevations don't get that snow melt. Of course, wildfires always a perennial issue in the Northwest, but have become more severe and intense in recent years. And insect outbreaks as well, where maybe a tree wouldn't have succumbed to an insect outbreak if it were fully healthy, but if it's already stressed by drought and by lack of moisture, then maybe those insects are able to breach the defenses of the trees and really create havoc.
So I can recognize that this is a bit outside your area of interest, but these signs that we're seeing that climate change is affecting the forests, is the general forestry industry, I'm talking about the big firms, the tree farm companies and so on, are they acknowledging that the climate's changing and that it's going to change their business model?
Definitely. I mean, they're certainly aware of it. And as I think are a lot of businesses where their income depends on something that is dependent on something as capricious as climate and, you know, day-to-day weather and seasonality, certainly something they're aware of and taking some actions to address.
So you mentioned insects. For some strange reason, I find insects and trees interesting. And I know the mountain pine beetle has decimated large swaths of forest, not so much west of the Cascades here, I don't believe. So are insects, are they presently, or are they going to be a challenge for us here west of the Cascades?
Yeah, it's a lot of the insects that we're seeing, they're already present, but those insect attacks become more of a concern when the forests are already weak. Healthy forests are naturally much better able to withstand any insect attacks. For example, one kind of interesting example is with some beetles, the tree will actually use some of the resin and sap to drown insects, but if it doesn't have enough water from a drought, then it isn't able to create enough resin and sap in order to drown the insects that might be attacking it. So that's one small way that climate can impact the resistance that a tree might have to beetles. And it's not necessarily any particular species in any one species in particular that we're worried about for the Northwest. It's really, you know, we're expecting them kind of across the board to increase, and really managing for the diversity and competition-based stress should help improve some of that resilience to pests. You know, pests are really likely to be more attracted to the stressed forest. So if we have a forest that's managed well, that's less stressed, that has a little bit more water resources, for example, then it will be less susceptible to insect attack as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. So just the notion that the regularity of water supply to the trees can impact what the insects can do there. And to me, that kind of points up that when we mess with the environment, we can't really know all the consequences of what's going to happen from us messing with it. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. And I think that's really one of the foundational ideas around ecology in general, is that there are so many complex factors going on. We can try to understand everything, and we can do a good job at understanding part of it. But really, there are so many relationships, complex relationships in an ecosystem that we're not aware of, that, you know, if we take something out, you never know what's going to be leaning on it that might fall.
Yep, for sure. So we are getting a little close to the end here. We got a little time left. But in the remaining time, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, well, just brief background. Down here in Pierce County, the county has taken on tree planting and is creating a formalized carbon offsets plan, which shows a lot of promise. I'm pretty enthusiastic about the idea. And so the work that you do there at NNRG, does this intersect at all with use it with carbon offsets?
I hope it will eventually. I'm personally a fan of carbon offsets. I really like that economic incentive to reduce carbon offsets. And I like the fact that it has an economic advantage to landowners. Admittedly, like to this point, it's been pretty hard to economically incentivize landowners at a really small scale on the mitigation side. It's a really rigorous process generally to vet those carbon markets, and it's not often financially viable for the small scale landowners. I am really hopeful that we'll get there eventually. But regardless, you know, if you have an adapted forest, it also has better mitigation potential, just perhaps not that carbon offset. So you know, my response is, you know, I hope it's in our future, and I hope we find a way to incentivize some of the smaller landowners as well soon.
Yeah, it does seem like it can be a great win-win in terms of we're pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and that the landowners you refer to can get some income from that. It seems vaguely related to farmers putting up a wind turbine on their land. It takes up just a little tiny bit of land, but it brings in some income for them and provides for some clean energy. So
yeah,
whenever we can find a, excuse me, go ahead.
Oh yeah, of course. Sorry to interrupt you. It's also, yeah, you can think of it as a benefit in how you're managing your forest. You know, with clean water and fish habitat, occasionally you'll be able to get some kind of income from that, but it's usually, unfortunately, not something that landowners get paid extra for, but it's something that is a really positive benefit for a well-managed forest.
Well, we are close to out of time here, so anything else you'd like to add before we kind of wrap up here, Rowan?
Well, I should probably mention that if there are any landowners out there who wanted to know what some of the actions that they can take are, I would definitely recommend checking out our website, nnrg.org, and we have a newsletter as well. And if you would like to get some more support in how you're managing your individual forest, we would love to support you. That's what we're here for.
Well, we'd love to support you too. And I will. We will have some program notes online, and I'll give a reference to that after we've finished up with our conversation here, so that if people do want to know more, they absolutely can. Well, so just to wrap up, Rowan, I really appreciate you, your organization, the fact that you seem like a very practical bunch of folks, but you're keeping your eye on creating a healthy future for us in this area that you've chosen. So thanks so much for what you and your organization does, and best wishes going forward.
Well, that's our goal. And thanks so much, John, for having me.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
So there you go. You know, it's good to know that there are people like Rowan and the Northwest Natural Resources Group out there. They're doing practical and effective things towards creating a happier future. And they're doing that by fostering healthier forests. At the same time, those healthier forests are rebuilding one of nature's perfect carbon mitigation systems, and that's forests. What's the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. The city of Tacoma's got a tree coupon program going on right now. You can get $30 per tree that you purchase and plant, up to three. I'll put a link to that resource in our program notes. And politically, it's up to us to change the motivations regarding how other folks who use the forests in an unwise way, it's up to us to get them to change their motivation, and that's done through the political process. So we need to be political. I'm thinking about organizations like 350 Tacoma and Citizens Climate Lobby in Tacoma, good organizations that are working towards a livable future. Speaking of program links, you can find those links at ccltacoma.org. I'll have the notes there for this show. And also, I'd love to hear from you if you've got a comment to make about this or any other show, John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.